Okay, so thank you to the organizers. I tried to make the talk as short and concise as possible. I only have 10 slides, so that means we should take about 2 hours or something like that. So let me give you the punchline right now. I'm going to be taking static and frictionless packings of disks in 2D, and I'm going to be poking on them in various ways. And I just want to convince you there are three different kinds of tests I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be poking on individual particles to measure the point response. I'm going to be shearing small regions of bigger systems using fixed rigid boundary conditions, no slip boundary conditions in small boxes, and then I'm going to be doing free, unconstrained homogeneous deformation of large systems, and we are going to see radically different things in each of those three cases, and it's going to depend sensitively on how close we are to the jamming transition and the excess number of contacts beyond the Maxwell threshold. So that's it in a nutshell. So most of the work has been done by these two guys. Ark is in the room, and Kamran has just left for Grenoble to start a postdoc with Jean-Louis and Kristen Martins, and we were supported by DMR and CBET. Okay, so just let me skip this in the interest of time. So the kinds of systems that I'm going to be thinking about are soft glasses. So I don't really have to spend much time explaining this group. So I'm thinking about particles suspended in liquids. They can behave like other amorphous solids, like conventional glasses. The particles can be solid, like in a paste. They can be liquid, like droplets in an emulsion, or they can be air bubbles, like in a foam or a mousse. And so there are many technological applications. So in this talk, we're going to restrict attention to systems that are athermal. The particles aren't doing anything unless I'm driving them mechanically. The particles have to be deformable. All the elasticity is coming from not entropy, but really elasticity as I'm deforming the contacts. And I'm going to be limiting my attention to the jam side of the rainbow, right? So for me, the other side of the random close packing point is on the other side of the world, and we are not connected to that. Okay, so this is my favorite picture of a mad scientist right here. So this is J.D. Bernal, and so many of you might be familiar with his experiments on random close packing that he did in the 60s. He basically took a bunch of steel ball bearings, poured them into a balloon, and he, you know, sort of crunched them down as tightly as he could, and he found that they packed in at about 64% volume fraction of the disks. And what he did was pretty ingenious. Inside the balloon, he put some paint, right? And so the particles that were actually touching, what would happen is there would be, you know, some capillary bridge that would form outside. And so when he took the particles out of the balloon and they let the paint drain, so the particles that were actually in contact would have no paint at the point of contact. And then the particles, there were lots of hangers around. And so Corey is not here anymore, but Corey has spent a lot of time convincing all of us that the particles that were left hanging around are very important for the contacts that are left hanging around, not quite in contact, are very important for the physics of these systems. And so Bernal could see those because the ones that were just near contact but not touching, they had no gap where there was no paint in the middle, and he could also count these. So I think it was an ingenious experiment. So, I mean, there's been a lot of work on this done more recently in different contexts, but the point is that if you think about, if you go back to Maxwell, what Maxwell said is if I have some kind of structure, if I have a set of points, and I have some constraints on the distance between certain sets of these points, I ask, how many constraints do I need to have a structure that has at least a chance of being rigid? I need as many constraints as there are degrees of freedom. Okay? And so it turns out that Bernal found that the number of contacts was right in the ballpark for this Maxwell threshold, not too far away, after he packed the particles in. So that's a brief history of okay, so just briefly, some experiments. So this is basically some work that was done by Tom Mason and Dave Waits in 1995. It's basically very well controlled high tech mayonnaise, right? So it's a simple oil and water emulsion where they were able to precisely control the volume fraction of the stoichiometry between big drops and small droplets, and control the size ratio between the big droplets and the small droplets. This is a picture from Dan Blair's group. You can go in with a microscope, look at these things, and try to back out what the forces are, the contacts between the droplets. But anyway, the point is, if they measured the osmotic pressure, they measured the low-frequency storage modulus as a function of volume fraction. There was a rapid change right around Bernal's threshold of 64% volume fraction, and then the osmotic pressure and the shear modulus turned on very quickly as a function of volume fraction. And we're going to be interested in this regime here where things are just turning on.
So here, both rock and shear were essentially doing more or less the same thing.
They were doing more or less the same thing. So don't pay too much attention to this particular data. I want to think about more well-controlled model systems for now, right? But this kind of behavior here and is what we're interested in. So quantitatively, no, I'm not going to try to claim that I can match what's going on in this experiment from 1995. I think there have been more recent experiments on granular systems where there's a more controlled measurement of the modulus. Okay, so it's just a cartoon, not meant for high fidelity comparison. So something else. So why do I really care about the about these packings at the jamming point? Well, I would like to think about what happens when you put them into flow. And so one thing that people have done. So this is a slightly different system. These are micron size hydrogel particles. You can change the temperature, you'll make the particles swell or de-swell, so you can pack them in at a fixed number density and change the volume fraction. And it turns out that if you're above the threshold, if you're above the random closed packing point, if you look at the flow curves, the stress as a function of strain rate comes down to some yield stress. If you're below that volume fraction, the stress does not go to a plateau, you end up with a fluid at low shear rates. And then the question, my big picture question is this. So these are sort of the two. This KITP program is about avalanches and sort of dynamically critical behavior in driven systems, which would be embodied here in this jamming phase diagram in terms of the yielding threshold. So I should say, so this is a jamming phase diagram that I've taken from a PRL from Huizinga and Barat. On this axis I have the stress that I'm putting on this assembly of particles. On this axis I have the volume fraction that I give to the particles. And the point is that below what we saw from the previous slide in the rheology curves is that below that critical volume fraction, there really is no yield stress. Above that critical volume fraction, there is a yield stress. We've spent a lot of time talking at this meeting about what happens when we cross this threshold and just start to yield. Okay. So my question is, what happens when we mix these two behaviors? The big picture question, what I won't address in this talk, but to give you some idea about why this is an interesting question. So we also know about what happens when, Corey and others have taught us what happens when we move along this axis and the packings lose rigidity. Okay, so how do these two things mix together? When I have a packing, when it's quiescent, it's on the verge of losing rigidity. Can it still sustain this Bercy avalanching behavior that we know and love in terms of the yielding transition? Okay, so what happens when I take this peanut butter and this chocolate and mix them together? Do we get something interesting? Okay, so the models that I'm going to be using are very simple. These are all variants of Durian's bubble model. I have a contact potential. If my disks are overlapping, I throw a harmonic spring between them. They want to push apart. It's a linear spring. For most of what I'm going to tell you, it's not terribly crucial that this is a linear spring, but I use linear springs in the data that I'm going to be showing you. If I shear them, I'm shearing them like this, but for purposes of this talk, I don't think I'm going to get to the point where I'm shearing them. Okay, so now for the meat of the talk, so I won't really get to this material. I'm going to be talking about elasticity. I'm going to tell you about the scaling laws that we see in the elastic response near the critical point by looking at the point response, a constrained homogeneous deformation, and an unconstrained homogeneous deformation. Okay, so this is a little review of what's known about the jamming transition and elasticity in these random packings. So suppose I do have now, consider I have a nonlinear spring between my particles. So the force goes like the overlap to the power of alpha. So for instance, for a harmonic spring, alpha would be 1. For Hertzian compact, alpha would be 3/2. And so these are some previous results that were Corey and Andrew Liu and Sid Nagel and Leo Silbert were primarily responsible for demonstrating this stuff numerically. So the excess number of contacts beyond what Maxwell would claim you need for the threshold, for just the chance of being rigid, goes like the excess volume fraction to the 1/2. Okay, and so this is this is independent of force law, independent of dimension, independent of polydispersity of the packing, and this relates to Bernal's particles that are almost in contact. Right. So if you remember those guys that formed the full capillary bridge between those steel balls that were almost in contact. As I compress my packing above the random closed packing point, those particles that were near that threshold are going to become, those contacts that were near that threshold point are actually going to close. That's what's responsible for this excess contact as I compress the packing. So this is a non-trivial result. If I think about what the pressure is doing as a function of volume fraction, it's more or less trivial. So I imagine that the volume fraction, that the pressure is going like the volume fraction to that same power alpha. What's that saying? I have some typical, for the contacts that are active and in intimate contact, there's just some length scale that I get if I change the volume by some fraction. If I change the volume by some fraction, I'm going to change the overlaps, the contacts that are actually already in contact by some fraction, that's going to change the pressure. So this is what you would naively expect for how the pressure would depend on the volume fraction. And so this implies, since the pressure, since the compression modulus is just the derivative of the pressure with respect to the log of the volume, the compression modulus also scales in a very simple, naive way. Okay, with it scales like the average overlap to this power alpha minus 1, and the average overlap basically scales like the excess volume fraction. Okay, so this piece here is trivial. This piece is non-trivial. And then what happens with the shear modulus is extremely non-trivial, and what's found is that the shear modulus goes like the excess volume fraction to the alpha minus 3/2, right? So for the case of, you'd have one thing for the case of a harmonic contact, you'd have another thing for the case of Hertzian contact, but if you take the ratio of the shear modulus to the compression modulus, what you get is that the ratio of the shear modulus to the compression modulus is always linear in the excess number of contacts above Maxwell.
Excuse me, correct?
Yes.
Is that formula correct?
Sorry.
Is there a type of alpha called 1?
Yeah.
Then it kind of diverges.
Which one?
The one for the shear modulus. I'm wondering if there's a chance that definition of alpha.
Oh, could be two. I'm sorry. Should be. Yes, two. Sorry. Should be two. Should be two. It's the wrong alpha.
Like, yeah. You're using the alpha.
This is the alpha for the energy. I'm sorry. So somehow this got mixed up. Thank you. So this alpha here is apparently not equal to this. This alpha here should be the alpha for the energy, not the force law. Okay. Thank you.
Just to make sure that we didn't discover a new divergence.
No, that's right.
Because in this field, it happens often.
This is the type. I need an extra. I need a plus one right there. Okay. Plus one. Thank you. Okay, and so these are plots here. This is from Corey's work with Andrea and Leo and Sid back in the day, looking at the. This is a Jean-Louis error. I've cut and pasted, and I'm at too low resolution to read what the plots actually are. But I think this one was the pressure, and you can see the pressure. Yeah, so naive expectations. The pressure is doing what you would naively expect, and the shear modulus and the excess number of contacts are both doing these non-trivial things. Okay, so that's just a lightning review of what has been known for a long time about jamming. And so there's a question about whether or not, if we can think about this as some kind of secular phase transition, there should be some kind of diverging correlation length, what might it be? And so this basic idea that goes back to Witten and Viard and Nagel is that there's a simple counting argument, right? And the counting argument goes like this. So this is a picture from Carl Goodrich that appeared in Soft Matter very recently. And what he's doing is he's playing a pebble game to try to identify the rigid clusters in this particle packing. So he prepares a packing by quenching at zero temperature with a fixed number of particles in a box. He relaxes that box to the desired density. So he's controlling essentially the pressure, essentially excess number of contacts beyond Maxwell. And what he does is he then pretends, he looks at those contacts and he makes a bar network out of the system. And he asks whether or not that bar network is rigid. And the red particles here are the largest rigid cluster. And he cuts out a square from his material. And he makes the square smaller and smaller. And he continues to ask, what's the largest rigid cluster? And at some critical size of that box, the largest rigid cluster jumps instantaneously from the size of the box down to this tiny thing here. Right? So this is the rigidity length scale. Right? When you cross over from this behavior to this behavior, and you no longer have rigid spanning clusters. Okay. So if you say that the number of excess contacts, so there's a simple scaling argument here. So when I'm cutting a boundary, what I'm doing is I'm releasing some of those constraints that live on the boundary, right? So I'm helping out Maxwell, and so I'm releasing a number of constraints that are proportional to the perimeter right here. And I have a bulk term that goes like L to the D. I'm releasing L to the D minus 1. So there should be some characteristic excess number of compacts that goes like the ratio of L to the D to L to the D minus 1. Right? So my critical length is going to go like 1 over the excess number of compacts where this transition happens right there. Okay? So this is the rigidity length. Then we can ask, well, does this rigidity length in some way reveal itself in the elastic properties of the packing? And yes, there's an argument for that. So this is a PRL from Silbert et al. In 2005. What they've done, there's an argument I don't want to go into now, that relates this characteristic length to a characteristic energy scale, assuming, making a modest assumption about the structure of the floppy modes when I go from here to here. Okay, and if I look at the structure of the normal modes at that energy scale, and I resolve the normal modes just onto the transverse piece, so I basically just take, this is a particular normal mode near the energy that's given to me by this kind of an argument here, and if I look at the transverse structure of that normal mode, I can see a length scale that's going like the excess number of compacts, I'm sorry, the excess volume fraction to the minus 1/4. Okay, so here we have something that's going like delta phi to the minus 1/2. Here we have something that's going like delta phi to the minus 1/4. And now there's a little bit of conflict in the literature. So Wouter Ellenbruch and Martin van Hecke's group in 2009, what they did was instead of looking at normal modes at some point in the spectrum of the system, they actually took a particle and they poked on it, and they made a very particular kind of measurement for this paper right here. What they did, they took one particle, they swelled it just a little bit, and they measured the fluctuations in the normal forces in response to swelling that particle. And what they found is a characteristic length scale, like delta phi to the minus 1/2, which is more like the rigidity length. Okay. More recently, so this is just a couple months ago, Eran Lerner and Mathieu Riard's group did something similar but a little bit different, and they claimed that they could not reproduce these results, that the elastic length should go like delta phi to the minus 1/4, which Silbert and company had measured. And they claimed instead, if they poke on one of the bonds in the system, they give it a little extra force, put in a force dipole, and then they measure the fluctuations in the response. They see length scale coming out that goes like delta phi to the 1/4. So there's some conflict here, and we were coming in, and one of our goals was to try to resolve the conflict by, with one probe, trying to see if we can measure both of these length scales at the same time. Yeah, Vincenzo.
Can I make a quick comment?
Yes.
That transverse length scale,
yes,
can also be seen in a scattering experiment. If you try to sign a numerical experiment, at least that's what we could see in numerical experiment.
Sure.
And there's an interpretation of being a mean free path of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
The origin of those two things is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
One is the length scale of stability, as you explained. The mm-hmm. other one characterizes disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that when you have a sample that has both, you can see both of them, it's something that is not necessarily a conflict.
Mm-hmm.
It just means that they're measuring two different things. Do you see what I mean? Like, you know, on the same sample, you can do a scattering experiment mm-hmm. and say, how far does the phonon go?
Mm-hmm.
And that's parameterized by the fact that that structure is disordered.
Mm-hmm.
The other length scale is a length scale about the rigidity and stability that you could extract even on an isostatic lattice where there's no disorder whatsoever.
So I certainly believe that you could have both at the same time if you're probing different things and making different measurements, and that's what I'm going to show you, and I don't think I completely agree with you 100%. But I think the claim here was precisely that you couldn't. They did essentially the same thing, and they could not see what these guys had seen. Okay. But I will try to explain in a simple way where these two different lengths, delta phi to the minus 1/4 and delta phi to the minus 1/2, come up within a single simple kind of measurement. They're both in the Green's function. They're both in the point response, and that's what I'll show you next.
Okay,
so what we're doing, so there are three different kinds of measurements I'm going to make on these systems. Number one, just going to poke a particle in linear response, measure on average the fluctuations that I see. And so this is basically inspired by things that Antangi had done in Lyon many years ago, back in 2004. This is a picture from her work on Leonard Jones, where they're poking a particle and they're looking at linear response. So now here's my system. So if we measure by doing a global shear, the Lamé coefficients lambda and mu, or here I guess I'm calling it g, and I take an actual system at a volume fraction of 85%. So I should also mention the particular mixture of particles here that I'm using. The big guys are 40% bigger than the small guys, and I have an equal ratio, equal number of big guys and small guys. This is the precise same system that Corey and company have been working with for many years now. And so this is, if I take one of those packings at 85% volume fraction, the jamming transition is something like 84.6. If I poke on one of the particles, this is one particular linear response function. If I go to 90% volume fraction and I poke on a particle, this is one particular linear response function. Mm-hmm. This is what you would get using the lambda and g. Yes, Jim. I'm sorry? It virtually I displace it. This is all linear response. Right? So I put an infinitesimal force downward. And so this is what you get, arbitrarily normalized. I'm putting an infinitesimal force downward on the central particle.
You're right? Holding the rest of the...
And I'm poking everything up with an equal restoring force so it doesn't shoot off to infinity. So I'm using linear response, right? So elastic is a loaded word here. So this is what you get from continuum elasticity. If I take the lambda and g that I measure at this volume fraction, mm-hmm. and this is what I get using continuum elasticity if I take the lambda and g that I measure at this volume fraction. Okay, so clearly, as I get further away from jamming, I get closer and closer to the continuum behavior. And this has been known, but we're doing an analysis that's a little bit different than what people have done before. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the power spectrum. And so if you think about it, if I'm poking downwards, I'm going to break into the longitudinal and the transverse pieces separately. If I'm poking downward, and I have a longitudinal wave that's propagating horizontally, I'm not going to pick up any of that power because the polarization is going to be completely perpendicular to the direction that I'm poking. That's why in the continuum solution, I get no power horizontally for the longitudinal when I'm poking vertically. On the other hand, if I take a transverse wave and I orient my transverse wave with a wave vector going along the direction that I'm poking, the polarization is going to be perpendicular and I'm not going to pick up anything either. So that's why there's no power. And no power in the continuum solution. Okay, and so this is the solution. I'm just looking at the point response. I have a factor of 1 over q squared, and I have some angular dependence. So something to point out is that in the longitudinal solution, I have a compression modulus plus shear modulus in the denominator. Mm-hmm. But for the transverse solution, I have a shear modulus in the denominator. We know the shear modulus is vanishing. So the transverse is going to completely dominate the longitudinal in general, right? So I'm very careful here about separating out the longitudinal from the transverse in my computer simulations where I can have very, very good data. In an experiment, I would imagine that it would be very, very tricky to pick out this guy because he's going to be orders of magnitude smaller than this guy here.
Right? So how do you know which one? Just to be clear, how are you separating them? How do you know which is longitudinal, which is the transverse?
When I take a Fourier transform, I have to project the Cartesian component.
Oh, just in the projection, not by tracking in.
Yeah, no. So that's what I do. So basically, I take every one of it. So these are small systems, but in the big systems for which I do the analysis, I take each picture like this. I do a Fourier transform, and by Fourier transform of the vector field, I mean I have to decide whether I'm thinking about a longitudinal or transverse wave. I take the power by squaring at each wave vector. And I average over many, many different configurations, and this is what you get.
I just don't think that would be that different. you'd have the same experiment. It would be no more difficult to do that in an experiment.
So what I'm saying is that the power corresponding to the longitudinal modes is going to be very, very small compared to the power in the transverse modes. Right? So if it's down by a couple of orders of magnitude, you're already in the noise.
So small, then you don't pick them up.
Yeah, the longitudinal displacements will be small.
The process is the same, but the number of digits he has is separate.
I've got lots of digits on the computer.
I wanted to be clear what you were saying. Yes. Special. Yes.
Okay. So anyway, right. So the g in the denominator is what basically kills the longitudinal relative to the transverse. And so what you see is that if you go to very long wavelengths, you start to recover the overall anisotropy of linear elasticity pretty well. But if you go out to intermediate wavelength, maybe even something like intermediate wave vector. So this corresponds to maybe tens of particles. You're really just into the noise, right? So when you're close to the particle
you
core,
something there
sorry.
Long wavelength.
What are we looking at?
I'm sorry. So this is just again, this is the power spectrum.
No, but what feature are you pointing to that we can definitely?
I'm trying to compare this
Yeah.
To that? And I'm saying that there's,
like,
sorry. So there's, so you're supposed to see there's anisotropy here, right? So this guy has a lot of power up and down. This guy has a lot of power to the sides. And I'm saying that once I go past a wave vector of maybe 10 of these units, I completely lose the anisotropy.
Right in the center, you can sort of see it.
So there's yeah. So if I blew up the center, you would see this anisotropy. So the core looks the same, right?
Thank you.
Once I get out this far, I really don't see anything that looks like this picture at all. It'll be clearer when in my next slide I'm going to go along this direction and that direction separately. Okay. So that's what I'm going to do. The next slide, I'm going to show you this direction and that direction. I'm going to show you this direction and that direction. And so I have to, yeah, Vincenzo.
I guess if I look at the denominator,
yes,
of that first thing that you have right there,
yeah,
and I take the k out, mm-hmm, in front, then I have, yeah, 1 plus g over k. Can I already see the emergence of the delta z to the 1/2 length? Yeah.
Sorry? So you're saying just because of the...
You see, like, the delta g over k is the square root of g over k. At least that's how it was coming out on the transport problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if... I shouldn't interrupt.
No.
You're doing a beautiful presentation, and I'm just...
Could be. We should think about that. That would be a reasonable explanation. Okay. But anyway, so of those two pictures I just showed you, I'm going along the two directions in each picture. This is for the top picture, the longitudinal, the bottom picture, the transverse. The black guy is the one that should be zero, okay? He's not zero. The red guy is the one that should not be zero and should actually go to the continuum elasticity solution. So this red dashed line is continuum elasticity that I get by the globally measured Lamé coefficients. And so over here, the black dashed line is what I get from linear elasticity. So you see that the longitudinal, along the direction where there is supposed to be power, departs much more quickly from continuum than does the transverse. The transverse is pretty good out to pretty large wave vectors, so down to pretty short length scales, whereas the longitudinal goes away pretty quickly. And then if I look at the guy that's supposed to be zero, he is two orders of magnitude down from the other one. And if I go to smaller and smaller wavelength, eventually everything is noise and the directions that, and this is what I was just, this is what, Jim, you were supposed to pick up from this picture. Eventually, if I go out to large enough wave vector, I don't really see any anisotropic structure, right? So either direction is equivalent, right? That's this length scale out here, where these guys become equivalent, okay? All right, and so you can probably guess what's coming up. So I'm gonna scale these things by the continuum prediction, right? And I'm gonna average over angles. So if everything worked out to be continuum, I would see one. And so this is for the longitudinal, and I'm now going to do this for many different pressures. Okay, so this is my highest pressure, my highest volume fraction, decreasing the pressure going towards jamming. As I go towards jamming, I get further and further away from linear elasticity, both for the longitudinal and for the transverse. Like we saw before, the deviation in the longitudinal from linear elasticity is much stronger. And what's suppressed in these figures is that the overall amplitude of this guy is suppressed relative to that guy because I'm normalized by linear elasticity.
Okay.
And then these plots are screaming for rescaling, and so I will succumb to the demand. And so if we rescale the longitudinal power, if we rescale the wave vector by the pressure to the minus 0.4, okay, mm-hmm, so it's not 0.5, but I would claim that it's much closer to 0.5 than what I have to scale the transverse wave vector by. And the transverse wave vector I have to scale by pressure to the minus 1/4, which is spot on with the transverse length that people have been talking about. And this one, I would say, is not terribly far away from the rigidity length. There may be issues, we're just not in the scaling regime yet. It's very tricky to do these measurements because we're going to long wavelength in a finite box, and then you don't have good angular resolution at the, so. I just want to point out that the main numerical challenge in all of this was just quenching the system. So if you have so we went out to systems that were 320 on a side in two dimensions, and it takes on a fast computer with lamps, it takes even a couple days to quench to zero force. It takes a long time to quench near jamming.
What's the lowest packing fraction that you
use? 85%. So the pressure is down by, say,
10 to the minus.
We're down by like one or two orders of magnitude in pressure going from here to there. And I think the contact number, the excess contacts, is in the ballpark of 1%. So delta z is in the ballpark of 1%.
10 to the minus.
Okay, so the story is that for the For the point response, longitudinal, the wavelength, the characteristic length goes like pressure to the minus 0.4. For the transverse, it goes like pressure to the minus 0.25. Okay. All right, now we're going to take a short detour because I want to talk about this non-applying elastic formalism. What I'm going to be doing, instead of doing a point response where I pick one particle and I put infinitesimal force, I'm going to be gripping a square, deforming the square homogeneously with sort of no slip boundary conditions on that square, letting the particles do what they will inside, and measuring the modulus that I get. Okay, and so I want to take a little detour and explain the formalism for computing the shear modulus in one of these packings where we have all the non-affine rearrangements going on. Okay, so let's start with pretend that we have a crystal, okay, a Bravais lattice. And I'm going to make a small infinitesimal homogeneous deformation of the neighbors around one site in the crystal. Okay, so I do this. And so I ask, what do I need to do to maintain force balance on this particle? Okay, by symmetry, I don't have to do anything if it's a Bravais lattice surrounding this particle. Now, if I have a disordered cluster of particles, I start in force balance. Then I make a small homogeneous deformation of the neighborhood around this particle. I no longer have force. There's no symmetry principle that keeps me in force balance. So if I want to maintain force balance, I'm going to have to do something to correct those forces. So there will be some even at the level of a single cage around a particle, you will induce some non-affine motion of that particle by demanding force balance. Okay? So you can just take this picture at the single particle neighbor shell level and go to the full system. So there are a couple ingredients, right? So the one ingredient, I should have emphasized this. There's an object that we introduce here called the affine force. And the affine force is for each particle, if I make a homogeneous deformation of its neighborhood, what force do I induce on that particle, right? Those are the forces which must be canceled out by the rearrangements that the particles make. And so this is a picture in one of these systems of the affine force on each particle. So this is if I do an infinitesimal homogeneous deformation, what's the force that I induce on each particle that needs to be canceled out by the correction? And so these are the corrections, right? So you see there are very strong correlated motions in the corrections that have to come in to maintain force balance. These are the displacements. So these are the affine forces.
And then you plot
the correction. And then I'm showing, so these are the displacements that you need to cancel out those affine forces.
So why is there no evidence of the collective modes in just the force plot then? If you go back one page, this looks random to me.
And it should. It's all structural, right? So if I think... It's all structured. So I could tell you, right, if you give me a local cluster, I could tell you, just by looking at the near neighbors of that particle, I just look at the elements of the Hessian matrix corresponding to all the neighbors, I could tell you what the force is going to be on that particle when I make a homogeneous deformation of its shell. Okay. Now, if I ask, what do I need to do to bring those forces back to zero, that's going to be a very non-local kind of process, right? So I'm basically solving, if we write the equations down, what I'm doing, so I guess your question is, why should these objects look random and uncorrelated? If I believe that there are there's no correlation in the structure from one cage to the next adjacent cage, right, which I think is a reasonable starting assumption, right, that if I take this particle and I look at his neighborhood, it's going to induce some kick if I shear his neighborhood. Then if I go to this particle and I shear his neighborhood and I ask what's the kick that is going to induce on this particle, there shouldn't be very much correlation between those two things. That's these, okay. Okay.
Did you analyze this picture with this displacement in terms of some non-zero circulation? I mean, if you draw a closed curve?
Sorry, this one?
Yeah.
So you're asking if I can define some kind of defect. I'm not sure. I mean, these vectors can. Well, so Damien is not here, but so Damien has tried to do such things. But the point is that you really. This vector field can vanish. So I don't know if there's much you can say by doing something like a Burger's circuit. If the
some simpler description in terms of vestiges of freedom.
I'll show you other pictures. So I think it's important to take gradients of these kinds of plots, and I think we'll learn more by looking at a derivative, because there's a lot of information, like Jim was saying, in asking Emanuela about analyzing clusters rotating. I think it's important, my eye is picking up this, this motion of all these guys moving coherently together, but when I take a gradient, my eye will not focus on this piece anymore, right? So I will show you gradients later.
So here, you apply strain and you demand the force to be zero. You have to find these virtual forces that would guarantee that.
Exactly.
I guess this is a somewhat dual operation to going on a bond. Mm-hmm. Applying a stretching, there will be a local force and see the displacement that results from that.
Yes.
They will be strongly correlated with this guy.
Yes. All the information.
That the ratio between this non-affine to affine, the scale interest in the delta z in a way similar to the delta z to the one-off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because of the symmetry.
I mean, the affine piece doesn't know. I would claim that the affine piece doesn't know about jamming.
Right, but the non-affine knows. It would be the same divergence of the delta z to one off that you see from applying the bump stretching. It's just the
Sure. I think Jean-Louis has seen this, right? If you look at the amplitude of the non-affine elastic response as you get close to the jamming transition, diverges. No, is that not right?
Yeah.
The mean squared non-affine displacement per unit strain for a quiescent system near jamming diverges near jamming.
Yeah.
Right. So that's what you're saying. Yeah, and it has the same divergence, it has a square root divergence. Yeah. So I think you can say that.
Yes.
So that is sort of implicit in this
in this plot.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is how you use this formalism to compute the non-affine displacement fields. And so what about the modulus, right? So what I told you that I'm going to measure is the shear modulus and how that depends on the size of the region that I'm gripping. And so to measure the shear modulus, I ask, so what is, first of all, what's the stress? The stress is the total derivative of the energy with respect to strain, which turns out that since I'm in force balance, happens to be equal to the partial derivative of energy with respect to strain, right? Because I would have to do a chain rule on this guy. So the energy depends, in principle, explicitly on the strain through the boundary conditions on the periodic boundary, and then also explicitly on the particle position. So I'd have a chain rule going on here, but since I'm in mechanical equilibrium, the forces vanish, and this first term doesn't contribute, right? So the stress is just the partial derivative of the energy with respect to the strain, right? Maintaining the affine deformation. And then the shear modulus, the tangent shear modulus, is the total derivative of the shear stress with respect to the strain. So again, I do a chain rule, and this piece right here is picking up the, if I expand the chain rule on this thing, I'm going to have a partial derivative of the energy, the second partial with respect to displacements and strain, and the second partial of energy with respect to displacement and strain, these are the affine forces that I was just talking about, right? And so that's the affine forces that sit here. And then in that chain rule, I have to multiply that by the displacements. So the affine forces times the displacements, that's this object right here. This is the affine forces times the non-affine displacement. That gives me a negative definite correction to the modulus. So the non-affine relaxation always brings my modulus down. And so, and the next thing I'm going to show you is that if I restrict that non-affine deformation, I have to increase the modulus. And as I relax my constraints, the modulus has to monotonically come downward towards its fully relaxed value. Okay, so in general, if I have any linear system and I restrict one of the degrees of freedom, I'm going to increase the spectrum. Right.
It seems to me that with this very beautiful idea, you knowing something about the scaling of the non-affine behavior, yeah, how to be able to predict the scaling of G.
I think they go together. I think it's a chicken and an egg. It's a chicken and an egg issue, but I think those two things do go together.
Right, and in a way that one should be able to sort of see from those equations.
In principle, yes. Yeah. Okay, and so I think all the interesting stuff is going on in here, and none of the interesting stuff is going on in here.
Okay.
Right. Okay, so that's the detour. So we understand how the non-affine elasticity works, and these non-affine corrections always reduce the value of the modulus below what you would get for a free system. For a system that's constrained to deform affinely. And so now what I'm going to do again, I'm going to take one of my systems, I'm going to cut out square pieces, and I'm going to force the boundary of that square to deform homogeneously. I'm going to let the particles on the interior do what they will. Okay, and so it shouldn't be surprising. Well, so first of all, what do I get in the unconstrained system? This is well known. This is work. This is basically going back to Corey and Leo and company. So if I plot the shear modulus, which is here in black, and the compression modulus minus its asymptotic value, what I already told you is that these guys, at least for the harmonic springs, should scale like the distance to the jamming transition to the 0.5. Okay. Now, the question is, what happens when I take a small box? So this is what you get when you take boxes of different length. The R is the length of the box at different packing fractions. Okay. So what we know is that at the jamming transition, the net shear modulus vanishes, like delta phi to the 1/2, okay? At the same time, we know that the, quote, the affine modulus, what I get when I force everyone to move affinely, is not sensitive to jamming, so it is some constant, okay? So as I increase my box size, when I'm far away from jamming, it's innocuous. I only make a small correction to the modulus, well, not a small, some factor of order unity, right? So I go from, so these dashed lines here are the so-called Born moduli, right? They're the second partials of the energy with respect to strain. That's what happens if I take a second of the energy forcing everyone to move out finely. This is called the Born piece. And then this is the correction. Okay, so these are the Born pieces at the different volume fractions. So brown is furthest away from jamming, and I go towards jamming. This is basically just changing because the contact number is changing. And with harmonic contacts, I pick up basically one contribution to the affine piece for every contact that I make, right? So my number of contacts goes down, my affine modulus goes down, not by so much. On the other hand, if I look at the fully relaxed, corrected modulus, as I allow for all those corrections to come in, when I'm at jamming, the modulus has to go all the way to zero, okay? So, what we've done is we say, well, how quickly should the value of the modulus approach its asymptote? And so if you imagine what's going on is an interior versus perimeter kind of thing. So if I force the particles near the boundary to behave according to the affine rule, and I allow the particles on the interior to deform non-affinely and bring in those corrections to the modulus, it should be an L to the D versus an L to the D minus 1, right? So I have R to the D versus R to the D minus 1. So I should approach that asymptotic value like 1 over R, right? In any dimension, in two dimensions or three dimensions. The data is for two dimensions. So if you look now, if I plot now, if I normalize by the asymptote, and I subtract off 1, this is the data right here. And so you see the system that's furthest from jamming, they all seem to go like 1 over R as they go to bigger and bigger boxes, right? So this is, again, I'm plotting the residual value of the modulus above its asymptote. So these guys are all going to 1 over R behavior. And then if I scale the length by pressure to the 1/2, then I get a good collapse. And so what this is telling me is if I'm at a certain distance away from the jamming transition and I have a certain box size, as I approach the jamming transition, I need to grab a bigger and bigger box to get the same precision on the value of the modulus, right? So I'm going down in modulus. So just for, you know, to give you some idea about numbers for you experimentalists, you know, Karen is sitting right there, right? So if I want 10% convergence on the shear modulus, and I'm doing this by applying no-slip boundary conditions on a set of particles, if I go from, if I'm at 88%, if I go to 100 by 100 box, it'll give me 10% convergence. But then if I go to 85%, which is much closer to jamming, I need to go to box that's 500 by 500 to get 10% convergence on the modulus, right? And that scaling goes presumably according to the rigidity length, right? That's what this is telling us right here. So it's very similar to the picture that that Carl Goodrich showed us. Okay, so method number one, I do linear response by poking one particle. Method number two, I take a square and I deform rigidly at the boundaries. Now method number three, I'm just going to put on plane waves. And you might imagine that if you force a plane wave, you could pick up some interesting length. Nothing, right? So it turns out you really don't see anything related to jamming if I put on a plane wave. So here what I'm doing, I'm forcing the particles, these are the forces that I'm putting on the particles. These are the displacements that I see in response. I can measure the energy that I get per unit force when I extend it. I can extract the modulus from that. So these dashed lines over here are the infinite, what I get for, you know, using standard periodic boundary conditions, measuring the Lamé coefficients globally. What we see is that as a function of wavelength, only when I get down to very small wavelengths, below maybe 9 particles, do I start to see any dependence on the wavelength, right? So I approach very rapidly the asymptotic value. And this is true for all volume fractions. So it seems like there's nothing to see in the plane wave method. I really have to pin some particles to see any to see any impact of the distance to jamming on the modules that I extract.
But if you let the spring wave propagate,
yes,
in that deserted structure,
yeah,
you will start seeing a scattering length, which is one of the length scales, the one of the deltas into the one alpha.
I'm sorry, if I let.
Like, you know, there's one size, critical size, which is the critical size above which you can use the linear elasticity.
Yeah.
Then you can do some measures, like letting that wave try to propagate in your medium, which will be very difficult numerically. And then from the mean free path of that wave, how it gets scattered by this order, you would be able to see the second length scale.
I mean, I should be able to compute that by just doing a cross-coupling between this mode and all the other modes at different wavelengths.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
And so your claim is that if my calculation was to do this, so can you say it again? So I'm measuring.
So imagine that you take a wave.
Do I look at the lifetime or what?
Yeah,
what am I looking
example,
at?
How okay. Far it goes, yeah. So yeah. You want to make a wave packet with a given width. And look at how it spreads.
Yes.
The way it spreads will depend on how close you are to that critical point. I know it as a fact.
Yeah, okay.
But not
okay.
From doing it numerically with what you're doing, but the Kuba, for example, you can prove this. Mm-hmm. What length is Kuba is almost mostly there. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we should certainly talk. What I was about to say is that, so if I thought that since I couldn't see any interesting scaling from the compression modulus with my fixed grip small system, there'd be nothing to see if I did the analogous thing with here, instead of using transverse modes, if I used longitudinal modes and tried to measure a compressional stiffness. I didn't try. I assumed everything would be fine. But in some private communications with Steve Teitel, if you do a longitudinal mode, you do see interesting scaling, right? You don't get such a quick collapse. So there's something to be seen if you you try to do this this length scale probe using longitudinal mode, which is very surprising to me. I don't know if anyone understands that. Maybe we can talk more about that afterwards. Okay. So sort of 3A is there's a surprise if you put on a plane wave, you don't really see any effect of the distance to jamming. But now what we're going to do is we're going to put on just a global, I'm just going to shear the thing with periodic boundaries as I usually would, and I'm going to look at analyze the displacement fields that result. Okay? So I can put it into compression, I can put it into shear, I can do that at high volume fraction where I'm well away from jamming, and then I can approach the jamming transition. And so we already know that as I approach the jamming transition, the ratio of the shear modulus to the bulk to the compression modulus goes to zero, right? So it becomes effectively incompressible at jamming. And that's going to be an important piece of the story that will come up later. Okay, so these are just, I think we're good, right? I have a couple minutes. Okay. Okay, so if you look here, so these four shots right here are when I take a typical system at 92% volume fraction. This is a relatively big system. I guess it's all relative is all relative, right? So for us, it's relatively big. So this is 320 particles by 320 particles. This is what I get when I put the system into compression, when I put it into shear, and when I look at the dilatancy, which is the divergence of the displacement field, or I look at the vorticity, which is the curl of the displacement field, right? So here I'm picking off the longitudinal stuff. Here I'm picking off the transverse stuff when I compress or when I shear. And the direction of the sense of the shear is here. I'm compressing vertically and extending horizontally. Okay? And so what you see, if we look, we see these Echelby zones, right, which shouldn't be surprising for us. So here I'm putting it into shear, and I'm looking at the top and the bottom. I have dilatancy above and below this zone right here. And I have compaction to the sides. So this region is one of these canonical Echelby thingies, right? So I can look in dilatancy. I can look in vorticity. I see the same kind of thing in vorticity. I see white over here. I see black over here, which I'm compressing vertically. That means I want to do this or I want to do that. And so I would say that this is one of these Echelby zones. I have many of them. And what you can maybe make out from where you're sitting, but it would be better if I guess I'd had a blowout, is that in the back, we also have a set of dark black extended lines, right? And so these are, other people in the past have talked about weak planes in the material. So I think there's sort of two categories of animals. There are intense shear zones, and then there are extended weak planes in the back. And so I want to emphasize, this is all linear response. There's nothing plastic about it. I'm quenching to an equilibrium configuration. I'm looking at the Hessian matrix, okay? So that may or may not as we know, that may or may not be relevant when you're close to jamming. The nonlinear regime might become important very, very quickly when I perturb the system. But, you know, I like this safe starting point. These are pretty dense systems where there's a well-developed linear regime anyway. Okay. All right. So we also see a couple of these local Escherby type zones that are tickled when I put the system into shear. They also show up when I compress. Right. So it doesn't seem to matter very much whether I shear or I compress. I do pick up these Escherby zones. Now, when I move towards jamming, I was shocked. I thought that I would see something completely different. So remember, this length scale, if we talk about the length scale that's encoded in the longitudinal field, has gone up by, you know, maybe a factor of 10. The length scale in the transverse field, maybe not so much. Maybe that's one piece of the story, is that transverse length scale has not really done anything terribly spectacular at this point, going from this picture to that picture. But nevertheless, I was really surprised that we can see, if you look at just the vorticity, it doesn't matter if I put these guys into compression or into shear, I still pick out these, what I would say, are reasonably well-defined Escherby zones, right? So here's an Escherby zone down here in the middle, and they're rather large, right? So this is, again, this is 320 particles by 320 particles. I would say this guy here takes up maybe a quarter of my box. And so this may be related to these length scales people have invoked before in the glasses. We need to go beyond these length scales to get to, you know, some kind of convergent behavior. So the size of these guys may or may not have something to do with that. But, you know, at least I'm struck by how similar the vorticity fields look. If you look at the dilatancy, it looks pretty different, right? And so here, in the dense system, in the dilatancy, I can see an impact, sort of a coherent long-range effect of these local slips. Whereas if I go near jamming, and I look at the dilatancy field outside of the core of these shear zones, I really don't see much. And I think this is precisely because when I'm near jamming, I become effectively incompressible, right? Remember, my compression, the ratio of my shear modulus to compression modulus is going to zero, right? So I just think that the far field compression does nothing. And then if I look at the power, I'm going to skip quickly because I know I'm running out of time. If I just look at the power spectra for different volume fractions, again, under compression, under shear, looking at the dilatancy, looking at the vorticity, so this is essentially the longitudinal and the transverse, the transverse response has no idea how close to the jamming point I am, which I was really shocked. There's no free parameter here. There's excellent collapse, completely insensitive. Whereas for the dilatancy, I seem to pick out something. It seems to be that there's some kind of characteristic length, short wavelength that's coming up that intensifies but does not change wavelength as I approach the jamming transition. Right? So these brown guys are in dense packing at 95%. I can't tell the difference between a Leonard-Jones glass and a disk packing at 95%. You see something very similar for Leonard-Jones. Now, when I go towards jamming, I start to develop this peak here, and maybe you can imagine I get a second trough out there. I'm not sure what those are, but the length scales are not sensitive to jamming. The only thing that seems to depend on jamming is the intensity there. Okay, so I think I'm running out of time, and I'll just leave it with that. I poke, I shear, and then I shear with no constraints. And I see different length scales coming out of these two, and I'm very surprised at how insensitive this piece is to the jamming transition. Okay, so thanks.
Okay, I suggest, because it's lunch anyway, so we just defer the discussion to lunch. Let's make it again for a time.